which should meet some time next week. And the whole agenda of terms of offer is to study certain cosmologies in terms of more, or what we believe to be more fundamental or graphic factors, in order to gain insight in the contemplation of projects of that. So the goal of this direction, of which I should say, is of course at the immediate level to better understand scripture in a time and setting, and in particular to see how geography works in the language setting. But the grand goal we need to have in mind for a while now is to try to address the problem of English conditions in cosmology. Indeed, a quantum gravity description of cosmological similarities should in principle explain the precision of the event in setting up such a low entropy initial state. And since holography has emerged as a potentially fundamental idea in recent years in string theory, we thought it would be interesting to try to see whether it sheds light on this problem. In particular, we try to see how cosmologies are described in Gauthier theories, how the problem of the initial singularity shows up in the field of history, and then whether we can learn something from it by studying the field theory evolution. Now, as you all know, the holographic principle has only been made precise in the string theory on space that has been detected cosmological content. So in this case, the holographic principle states that string theory in the bulk of ATS space time is equipped with certain theories in the bulk. That's, of course, been very powerful conjecture because we've come to regard the gauge theory as a full definition of string theory on physical universe space times. Now, of course, the problem is that ABS typically doesn't have much of a cosmological dynamics, which sort of makes it hard to make progress. But Kelly and I have recently somewhat generalized the ABS-CFD correspondence, and in particular, we've constructed supergravity solutions where smooth regular ABS initial states, at some time zero, emerge from a dependent past and evolve to a different future. Now, of course, at these similarities, the gravity approximation breaks down, and we lose control over the gravity cell. But now we can turn to the dual theory of description and see what happens there. In principle, the dual pH theory of description should give us a fully quantum gravity description of what happens at the singularity, because it's dual string theory. So in particular, we could, in principle, map the initial data to sort of dual field theory state and evolve it using the ordinary theory and authority. And then we could go back to the gravity side and see, but first we could sort of ask the question whether the field theory evolution is well defined for all time, and what the corresponding bulk geometry at late times is from that corresponds to the evolved field theory state. So that's really the idea behind our work. And you could, of course, imagine different possibilities, either field theory in some evolution breaks down, or there is some sort of bounce to its similarities, or there might be other options. So the outline of my talk is, first, I will review these solutions, which I like to call ABS cosmologies, and then I will describe what is the dual field theory evolution. Then the third part is a discussion of a certain regularization of the field theory, which allows us to work out the dual field theory evolution in great detail. And then finally, I will conclude with some conjectures on real cosmologies, which arise from our conclusions on ABS cosmologies. Okay, so the setup is the following. We consider the low energy limit of strict theory with areas 4 plus a set of boundary conditions. 4 dimensions is not necessary, we can do reconstruction with other dimensions too, like that seems fine. So that's an equivalent to gravity, the master sector of this complexification, which we can truncate to gravity comparable to the scalar field. This is the field theory, the dimension for the scalar field, which has a negative maximum, and therefore that corresponds to the AES solution. Around the AES solution, the scalar has negative mass, but the mass is slightly above the Dirac Feynman bound, which guarantees stability under the usual boundary conditions. Now, for the more part of my talk, I will work in global coordinates in AES. So it takes a set form. And in all asymptotic AES solutions, the scalar field has to decay to zero at large gradients, which means, given its potential, it will behave. It's a big example of the drop of the. Okay, so the scalar field behaves as a combination of these two modes asymptotically. One behaves as one for R and the other one behaves as one for R squared. And then there are small coefficients. Now, the standard supersymmetric boundary conditions correspond to taking beta equal to zero. So in that case, the scalar field would decay as 1 over R, with 1 over R to the third coefficients. And the corresponding metric, if you include that relation, would follow like this. So note that there sort of this is relaxed compared to, for instance, the Schwarzschild AES solution. But nevertheless, with these boundary conditions, all the asymptotic AES symmetries are preserved. So this one of round 5 component would be the usual Schwarzschild mass, but there's the alpha correction in the one of round 4 component. But one can, in principle, consider more general boundary conditions in which we don't take beta equal to zero, but in which we consider beta to be some fraction of alpha. Now, generically, so these would be these boundary conditions. Generically, those boundary conditions would break some of the AES symmetries, but they're still invariant under global time transition, so you could define a conserved energy. And the conserved energy is simply derived from requiring the variation of the Hamiltonian to be well defined, and the circumstances that you add to achieve this are precisely, give you precisely the mass. One finds that the mass in these boundary conditions is finite, but it requires an explicit contribution from the scalar. For instance, for spherically symmetric solutions, it's given by N naught plus this explicit scalar contribution, where N naught is really the 1 over R to 5 correction to the metric. That's the, what we would say is the usual sort of.
What fixes the dependence of beta on alpha?
Well, so far I haven't. So far I haven't fixed it, but that's indeed that's your choice of boundary. Okay. Beta must be a function of alpha, though, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to integrate the charge. So you know that you have to specify something, but at this point I haven't said I haven't said one. Now, this construction in which you can sort of relax or generalize the boundary conditions on certain fields, certain metafields in your theory, is rather unique to these particular scalars that lie slightly above the Dirac Feynman. Because any scalar with a higher mass, with a positive mass, say, would have a decaying mode and a growing mode, and that growing mode at infinity would be excited to destroy the entire AES structure.
So this construction really rests on the fact that the mass of the scalar configuration is minus 2, which is below the Brightman of Friedmann part of plus 1. That's the precise. So now let me specify d tau alpha. And what we found a while ago was that although generically you break some of the ABS symmetries, there's a particular one parameter family of boundary conditions, which is invariant and all ABS symmetries, which is if you take beta to be a constant times alpha squared. So beta and alpha itself are generally dependent on all the other forms, the coordinates on the sphere. So that's the boundary condition I will work with for most of the part of my talk. And our claim is that for all values of k, so k labels a different boundary. Yeah, the value of k specifies the boundary. For all values, you find that there exists regular asymptotic ABS emission data, which evolve to a singularity that extends to the boundary of ADS in global time, in finite global time. And so that's what I mean by our cosmological solutions, because if this singularity extends to the boundary of infinite global time, that really acts like a difference in the ADS.
Is this like a super selection sector within some bigger theory, or is this really defining when you choose the boundary condition?
I think it is more like the final theory. Yeah, and I should also say that although these guys preserve all the ADS symmetries, they clearly break specific. Although you might be able, but I'm not sure if that's sort of an outstanding question, you might be able to embed these boundary conditions in a larger theory with more fields and thereby restore specific. But
I'm not sure. I'm a little bit surprised by your ability of choosing arbitrary function beta of alpha, because I think in normal ABS, so the dominant mode in principle is like adding an operator to the field theory, and that already defines the expectation value for alpha in the absence of supersymmetries to the
spectrum.
So here you're trying to say that,
I think we're entirely on the same line of thinking. I think it's related to Rob's question. By specifying my boundary conditions, I think indeed you're specifying a theory. And I will come to the dual field theory, and I think what will happen is entirely what you expect.
But my point is that you don't have that choice.
We do have a choice, because if we change the boundary conditions, we change the field theory.
Right, but beta is not the boundary, it's determined by the dynamics. If we have a field theory in which there is, if we add there some metrics that can be Eugene condensate, and that's not the choice, you have the Eugene condensate will develop, and will have an expectation well, and that would be just the effect if you use, for example, some mass parameters.
That is true at a certain. No, I think the picture is
what you're creating. Unless you have a good argument why the operator corresponding to the ones that you are performing in zero with has a flat direction, then that was an old paper of like what it gets fast.
Data is determined by the dynamics at a certain extreme of your theory intervention. But away from that, you have a whole.
I guess that would lead to a singularity. I guess that's what you're saying, is that in principle, will you have a singular solution?
I think we should, hold on for a minute, and then I think it will become clear what the dual feature is. Before I turn to the dual field theory, let me give you one example of such an ADS cosmology which can be constructed explicitly. And the simplest such cosmology you can construct by continuation from a Euclidean in-synchron. And in particular, this theory, this bulk theory with boundary conditions corresponding to these ABS event ones that are k not equal to zero. All these bar theories admit all four invariant Euclidean instantons. So these are solutions, Euclidean solutions, in which the metric takes its form, and phi, the product scale, is some function of rho. And so you find that for, so here I plotted the profile of phi, as function of rho, for a particular value of k. And you find that there's one-to-one correspondence between the values of k and the instanton solution. So there's always one instanton in each theory. And then once you specify the profile, which you specify by integrating out the field equation from the origin, b is the term of the scale factor, is the term, in terms of phi. And now the important point is that the slice to the instance of, if you restrict to the equator of that tree sphere, defines zero mass dielectric initial data for a Lorentzian solution. And furthermore, this Lorentzian solution you can typically obtain by analytical observation of the instanton. And what you find is the following. You find that the origin of the instanton becomes the light cone of the Lorentzian solution, and that the field outside the light cone is constant on these decider sizes of ABS. But inside the light cone, you find that the universe, the symmetry of the instanton guarantees that the universe behaves like the Rutherford universe, and because the potential is negative in the bulk, this Rutherford universe is collapsing, the field goes down in negative potential, and the scale factor goes to zero. So inside the light cone, you form singularity, which makes it out to the boundary when t goes to pi over 2. You could also see this from the outside, where the field is constant on these decider slices. If you change to global coordinates again, you find that the asymptotic profile obeys our boundary conditions. It's this particular combination of alpha and beta that we just fixed. But alpha is now time dependent. And in particular, it behaves like the initial value of alpha over cosine t, which also flows at rest goes to pi. Now, I should note that although alpha flows up, the coefficient of the one over r term, the field phi itself is fine. It reaches this value, which it has had in the life for a short time. So that's the simplest example of one of these ABS cosmologies, but I stress that there are many others that you can construct from various types of initial data. Of course, at the singularity, our supergravity approximation breaks down. So let us turn to the dual field theory and see if we can learn something from there. Now, what is a dual field theory? Well, with the standard supersymmetric boundary conditions, which amount to taking beta equal to zero, the dual theory is the usual 2 plus 1 CFT on its second and two bricks. Now, this theory contains dimensional one operators, which are symmetric traceless combinations of the adjoint scalars in the field theory. And since our bulk scalar falls off like 1 over r, one of these operators must be dual to our bulk scalar. And then the usual ABS-CFT dictionary would say that we associate, that we identify alpha with the expectation value of this operator. Now what happens if we impose different conditions in which beta is a function of alpha? Then we deform the field theory, and in particular, Witten has proposed a procedure for how what changes to correspond to the field theory, and proposed that choosing beta as a function of alpha would correspond to adding certain multi-trace interactions in the field theory. And in particular, the multi-trace interaction that would correspond to a change in the boundary conditions is such that if you replace the operator by its expectation value of alpha, then this relation should be satisfied. So let's apply Witten's proposal to our boundary conditions, and what you'll find is that our ABS invariant boundary conditions correspond to an H triple trace term to be CFTF. Where the coefficient gate is the same as the one that enters in the buffer. So here it's clear that K is defined by theory. For different K, we would have suffering a lot of traces. So that's a marginal deformation indeed, which gives force for the fact that our buffer coefficient indeed preserves the S invariance. So now that we have a dual field theory, let's look at what is the dual field theory evolution that corresponds to our ADS convergence. So as a warm-up, let's consider the classical theory, the classical field theory. And the key point to note is that the triple trace serve is not positive definite. If we neglect for a moment the non-abelian structure and identify our operator O with phi squared, so one of the actual scalars, then that would lead to a potential like this, where the usual phi to zero factor of the conformal field theory is now most relatively unstable. So here the phi squared term comes from the conformal coupling of the scalars in the field theory to the curves of the sphere, and this term in the potential comes from adding our triple trips. So here, in such a field theory, of course, there would also be instantons, field theory instantons, which describe the decay of the usual vector. And in fact, the evolution after the field that runs out of the usual vector is remarkably accurately given by this exact classical solution, which in fact reproduces the time dependency and the scaling decay of these supergravity solutions we had before. Remember that we are identifying phi squared with the expectation value of O, which is identified with alpha, and for our instanton solutions, alpha then like one of those attributes that is exactly three.
Yes. K was positive, right?
K was in the examples that it doesn't matter. Either you take alpha to be positive and alpha to be negative and K positive, or K positive and alpha negative. But in the example I've given you of the instanton initial data profile, I've chosen to be phi positive and K negative. But there's a symmetry in both. So far we are seeing the ADS-CFT correspondency nicely at work. It nicely reproduces the time dependent supergravity solution. But classically, we are not learning anything. We find a field theory evolution also at infinite time. Now, this conclusion dramatically changes if you consider the quantum mechanics of this system. In fact, the quantum mechanics of potentials which are involved from below is very understood. The way one deals with this problem is by defining a self-adjoint extension of the Kapitonium. That really amounts only to specifying carefully the domain of your Kapitonium, which then ensures that probability is not lost at infinity, because that's of course the problem. Once you have done so, you have unitary evolution for all time. And therefore, the quantum mechanics of this system suggests that the deterministic is not that form of evolution. Now, that's a little puzzling because the WKP approximation, when the field rolls down its negative potential, is very accurate. And in fact, you do find that a wave packet follows essentially the classical trajectory. But what happens when it reaches infinity is that it just bounces back. So we were surprised at first by this, because we thought, well, is this support from ADS-CFT for these big gravity vector transitions, which are envisioned in the cyclic universe model? Well, it turns out that it isn't really support, because what you find is that a bounce through the singularity requires exactly homogeneous initial data, which is, of course, precisely the system that the quantum mechanics of this considers. If you look at the full field theory, then you find that even while the field is rolling down, there are enormous numbers of particles which are created, And in fact, the evolution, rather than remaining homogeneous, becomes chaotic. So that sort of phenomenon of particle creation while the field is rolling down is called tachyonic predicting, and has been studied in great detail by Kaufman et al. And you find it's very efficient. All the potential energy which you get while the field is rolling down is converted into gradient energy and into particles. In fact, it's interesting to note that the evolution becomes chaotic, because we know that on the string theory side, if you would lift our solutions to 11 dimensions, then it's been shown by Damour et al. That the evolution towards singularities in these systems becomes chaotic too. That's these are the BKL oscillations, right? So you jump from one chasm solution to another. And you do see this in the field theory too. There is a very specific description of the chaos which arises from the field theory stuff. But anyway, the point is that in the full field theory, clearly a bounds to the singularity would then require a miraculous conversion of all the gradient energy back into a continuous mode, which obviously in kind of generic circumstances would not happen. So, in summary, a first look at the field theory side of the correspondence suggests that evolution does not happen, but that also generally a bounds does not occur. But we still haven't learned anything in the sense of what then actually happens at the singularity. So, in order to proceed, we thought it would be good to first try to regularize the field theory, which you can do by adding a small quartic trace term, which in our toy model would then correspond to adding a bifurcate term with some very small coefficient, which would turn the potential around at some point and give rise to a global ring. The idea would be that to study this theory first and then take a little bit away and see what happens. But of course, if we change the field theory, then we're modifying the bulk particle conditions, and indeed, applying with this procedure the other way around, we find that we're adding now epsilon alpha studio. So that slightly breaks ABS symmetries. But as I said, we have control over the mass and over the dynamics, so we can proceed. But changing the boundary conditions changes the dynamics in the problem, so we should be aware that in a regime where alpha is large, this will have a significant effect, and in particular near the singularities, this might modify the solution. So I now show that, I will now argue that indeed this is the case, that with these modified boundary conditions, the corresponding developed solutions, that the evolution that comes from our initial data, instead of forming a big crunch, you turn these big crunches into black holes. Now that's surprising because our initial data have zero mass. So it obviously can't be an ordinary Schwarzschild ABS black hole. Yes.
So, can you just remind again, what does it mean breaks ABS symmetry in your context? So you have alpha that in principle depends on time, right? And in addition, you have radial evolution. So, you're saying that when you add this little piece epsilon alpha cube, you can still solve this, and this is a partial differential equation, right? You'll end up solving because there is a time evolution. By saying that it breaks ABS symmetry.
Well, there's an easy way to see. Symmetry which is clearly broken is the conformal invariance. Normally, you can rescale the rate. Let's see.
But I guess my question is very simple. So with this, you can still consistent the equation.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's
okay. That's what I care. Yeah.
That's no problem. So, yeah, well, this is the coefficient of the one over R squared term, right? So if you rescale R, you can absorb it in a rescaling of R, and nothing happens. But now you've got good in over, so feed the conforming back. Okay, so first, the claim is that with these modified boundary conditions, we will turn the differential to a black hole. It can't be a Schwarzschild black hole because that has positive mass. And instead, the claim is that the relevant black holes to consider are black holes with scalar hair. So these are spherically symmetric black holes. The metric takes this form. These are field fictions. And what happens is that you specify the horizon size and the value of the scalar field of the horizon. You integrate outwards from the horizon, and generically, the scalar will behave as one of these two combinations again. So for every combination at the horizon, the derivatives are all fixed by the boundary conditions, you get a point, you integrate the field equations, and you get a point in the alpha beta plane. Okay, it's the alpha beta, I haven't specified my boundary conditions yet. So if you repeat this procedure for all values of phi of the horizon, you would get a curve for each value of the radius, each value of the horizon size. Okay. So some of these curves I show here. So these are three examples of such curves. This is the curve which I obtained by setting the horizon size to 1. And then these two curves are curves respectively for a very small black hole. And the other curve is the curve which you would obtain by integrating out from for the solid hole solution. Solid hole solutions would be sort of the zero size limit of these black holes. Now let's specify our boundary conditions. But specifying our boundary conditions is nothing else than specifying a second curve in this alpha beta plane. And evidently, the hairy black holes that obey given boundary conditions are precisely those solutions for which these two curves intersect. So, for instance, with our modified boundary conditions, the curve for negative k and positive epsilon would be something like this. And the black holes in that obey our modified boundary conditions would then be the ones that for which this curve intersects those curves. So you see that for small horizon sizes, for small radii r, we generically have two intersection points for each curve, which means we have two black holes of given size that they are boundary conditions in addition to the Schwarzschild ABS black hole. On the other hand, you see that for large radii, then this curve will keep on moving down. And this will be fixed, of course. So for large radii, we don't have a solution. So there's a maximum size we have only black hole solutions that obey these boundaries. That maximum size will increase for decreasing epsilon, because if we decrease epsilon, this will go down, and we will be intersecting more and more curves. With ABS invariant boundary conditions, this curve would simply continue to go down, so we would lose entirely the second branch of hairy black holes. We would have hairy black hole solutions of all sizes, but only one of these sizes. Okay, so to see that one of these solutions for given boundary conditions corresponds to the likely end state of the evolution of our instant potential data, let's plot the mass of these two branches of black hole solutions with these particular modified boundary conditions. Then you find that this dotted line is the mass of the first branch of hairy black holes, which corresponded to the first intersection of the curves. But you find that the second branch delta cos corresponding to the second intersection point has actually much lower mass, and in fact it has a mass which can be negative. And in particular, this second branch clearly contains a zero mass black hole, which is then, because it now exists, there is a black hole that our initial data can get evolved to, it becomes the likely end state of the evolution with our modified conditions of our initial data. So we can't solve the partial equation explicitly, but we now have a candidate black hole solution that the initial data can evolve. What happens if you decrease epsilon, so if you take the regulator away, then as I mentioned, the maximum size of the area black holes will increase. And what happens is that this point of the zero mass black hole moves up. So the radius becomes larger and larger. So the second branch becomes like this, and you move out like that. And in particular, the value of the field at the horizon of the zero mass black hole will, if epsilon goes to zero, tend to phi naught, where phi naught is the value of the field at the light cone of the evolution of the instanton initial data. And in particular, it is the value of the field where the initial data tend to, when the boundary hits infinity. This is the phi naught. And so that phi naught we obtain as a limit when epsilon goes to zero of our regularized evolution. So therefore the conclusion is that we are now recovering the decrunch of our original solutions where we had the eigenvalue conditions as the limit of a specific class of zero mass black holes.
That was my first question, but what is, I don't see how the construction that you just did somehow tells you how the space evolves beyond the crunch, because
yeah,
you put in a regulator, you get a black hole,
yeah.
And you remove the regulator, you get your
yes.
big crunch back.
Yeah. Now I'm studying the bulk with these regularized boundary conditions. Later, I will then turn again to the field theory and try to run. From the bulk, it's also to gravity, and we're never going to get beyond this data. What I want to argue here is because when we first saw that the Lagrange turned into a black hole, we thought, well, this is a pretty dramatic change. But when you then look at the limit, it turns out that this class of solutions is actually nicely connected to the limiting solution which we started. And in fact, a field theory interpretation of the Harry black holes, to which I will turn now, gives further support for this connection.
Can I actually ask about that? If what you started with had a single ADS boundary, the original cosmology.
Yeah.
But have you implicitly, in building a black hole, sort of done all the usual things a black hole do, like you've got another asymptotic surface, another.
And I think we get it also in the big crunch from the instanton. Continuation to the other side.
Right.
So I think maybe that's what maybe we did. Yeah. So maybe we did start with two different things. So. Because the origin of the instant one becomes a light cone,
mm-hmm.
and there you have opposite two sides that you can.
No, but I can have a light cone inside. You know, if I just have AGS pointed at the center, there's a light cone. But here you,
yeah.
I mean, you don't have a point at the center of the light cone. You've got sort of the neck of a sort of an Einstein-Rosen grid.
Yes.
So
yes.
It strikes me as still very
That's a good point. Yeah. I should have put you back.
Well, your solution could be an internal black hole at the end of the day. I mean,
we're producing a black hole from black hole.
It's a collapse.
No black hole. I guess this is.
But I can't evolve. I mean, it's not something that's time symmetric. I can't evolve backward, and I see.
Time symmetric.
So I would see a past horizon and a singularity, a white hole.
Absolutely. You know, this is not solution two.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm evolving the same initial data, which are time symmetric, which you get from this one, the different one.
Sure.
Yeah. So if we can evolve to the future and the past. So really, what I'm doing here. These people construct these kind of guys from time stream. Well, yeah, if you draw a Penrose diagram, it would look exactly the same, but it was bigger under a black hole, of course. That's a good point. Okay, so let me now turn again to the dual field theory and try to see what these Harry black holes correspond to in the dual picture. And the way to see this is through compute the effective potential for the dual operator O, but for the expectation that for the operator in the dual field. And quite remarkably, you can gain a lot of insight in this effective potential from the curves, beta naught, also the black hole curves, which are related, which we discussed before. And in particular, we have quite good evidence that the effective potential for the expectation value of the dual operator in field theory dual streets arbitrary deformations, is actually given by this function I've written down here, which is a constant, which I explained later, minus this integral, which is the integral over the curve under consideration, and then we add the arbitrary deformation where we replace omega by its expectation. And so the basis of our claim that this is the effective potential for the expectation value of the operator, where I should say that we are taking the expectation value in the state dual to our function data, dual to our black holes, and not in the vacuum. So the basis of our claim is that the extrema of this function are in one-to-one correspondences with black holes of size, or this particular size, that obey the boundary conditions according to the procedure. That's easy to see, take the derivative, and what we find is that the extrema are the points where these two curves intersect. But furthermore, the mass of each black hole at those intersection points is given by the value of what I claim is the effective potential for the hole at the corresponding extreme. And then you can see as follows. As I said in the beginning, the mass, the conserved mass of those black holes acquires the scalar contribution. Now, which depends on the particular theory or the particular boundary conditions we choose. For instance, let's first choose boundary conditions where beta is equal to one of these curves. In that case, because it's the same curve, all Harry black holes will be a solution of this size. Okay? But because we then have a family of static solutions in this particular theory, it means that we're taking beta to be one of these curves for a moment, say this one. then all solutions on this curve would be a solution of this theory, and in particular also the Schwarzschild KDS solution with that size. But that means that because this is a family of static solutions, that from the first law you find that the mass along that curve is constant in that theory, which tells you that for boundary conditions corresponding to this curve, the Schwarzschild mass equals n naught plus alpha beta. Therefore, for general boundary conditions, you can replace n naught plus alpha beta by the Schwarzschild mass minus the original curve, which is this one, and you get that the mass in a general theory is the sum of these functions, which is precisely graphic enough. So this constant is the Schwarzschild mass, and that, that function gives us the effect potential theory. So let's plot this effect potential for our particular modified boundary conditions. And what you see is that you get the following. So this is with the epsilon, with the regularization. You see that the effective potential for the dual operator has this shape. And in particular, it has three extrema here, here, and there, corresponding to the three black holes in the theory. One is the Schwarzschild AES, and the other one is the solution on the first intersection point, and here that's the secondary black hole. And as we saw before, the mass of this hairy black hole is positive, you can redraw from here, and the mass of this one is negative. So that is a natural interpretation of what's happening. In the dual theory, the Schwarzschild AES black holes are due to finite energy states in the usual vacuum, while the two branches of black holes, heavy black hole solutions, corresponds to excited states in the two non-trivial vacuum, respectively below the maximum and below the minimum of the effective potential. And I should add that a stability analysis of these heavy black holes supports this conclusion. If you look at unstable, if you look at spherical radial perturbations of these heavy black holes, what you find is that you find an unstable one there, and you don't find an unstable one on the second branch of heavy black holes. So that corresponds. That nicely fits in with this interpretation. You could also view the heavy black holes in the canonical ensemble, in which you select a temperature. And what you find is that, as you sort of expect from here already, that the black holes corresponding to excited states, thermal states then, in the global minimum of the field theory potential are thermal and thermal state. So by playing around with these boundary conditions, as far as the study of time-dependent radial CFT is concerned, you could generate a whole lot of theories and investigate those by looking for static flux solutions. In particular, with this example, we see that the field theory description nicely resolves this example of black hole non-uniqueness. In the product, there's only one charge, which is a mass, but for a given mass, we have either a Schwarzschild black hole or a heavy black hole. So you wouldn't be able to distinguish. Finally, let me now that we understand what these black holes are in the field theory, we can return to our time-dependent problem and see what the dual field theory evolution is of our regularized AES cosmologies. So we now understand that the formation of a hairy black hole in the bulk corresponds to thermalization in the new global minimum of the field theory. But we also have this evolution towards the faster variation data, which towards the future you should view as the fact that a rare fluctuation from this thermal state causes the field to roll back to the potential, and that fluctuation is due to the sudden evaporation of the black hole. So it's that fluctuation which describes the emergency of the instant initial data from the past singularity. And so we conjecture that at least qualitatively, this picture continues to hold when we take the regulated away. But we don't have much more concrete to say about this field theory state when we take the regulated away, although we're working on that. So on the basis of these conclusions in ADS, let me make a few conjectures on real cosmologies, which are not particularly groundbreaking or new, but it is what is suggested by our work in ADS. First, I would say that cosmological singularities are no endpoints for evolution. Instead, the evolution continues in some dual or perhaps orthographic theory, but there is generically no immediate transition from the crunch to the crunch to the bank, which connects the two same classical regimes. And then secondly, I would say that cosmological singularities are in some sense generic states in quantum gravity. And what we perceive as a big bang is an exceedingly rare perturbation, which gives us the same classical constant. So that's all we have to say so far on real. Thank you.
So, more questions? So when you approach the singularity, I would expect that on the string theory, on the gravity side, the upper prime corrections of course become important. To which extent do you have included these corrections on the heat theory side of the trace operators?
We should have all of those corrections,
sure. They should all be included on
the gravity side. Certainly in the regular
full picture.
Yeah, that's certainly in the standard flow of ADS. Now, the question is open, of course, when you take the regulator away. That's why we haven't had much to say about that case, because then the theory intervention becomes unbounded, and you might think that if you're relevant to a description, would be an open string theory out of the field. So that's the big issue, which is here. But in the regularized version, it should only be there.
So is this, the conversion from the ABS Schwarzschild black hole to the Carey black hole, is it more like a phase transition or a time transition? I mean,
it's like a phase transition.
So
at finite temperature, you could view it as a phase transition.
But you were saying in the Lorentzian way of theorizing that it would be like a time evolution.
It's the same as a phase transition. If you start with a Schwarzschild EPS and you wait long enough, there is a probability, e to the minus the difference of the actions, that it will spontaneously acquire this hair, so to speak. Yeah. A non-trivial field profile outside the
ground. But that sort of time evolution, which is like the incremental thermal evolution, that could rather different from the time evolution that we have. And what I'm saying is that
yes.
From the dual field theory, how do you recover
Okay. Good point. Okay, so we have this hypothesis effective potential. Now we should view this effective potential as a potential not in the time dependent problem, but in the corresponding to the sort of space of black holes, so where indeed this would be the Schwarzschild one and this would be the Hare black hole.
Okay.
This is not addressing our time dependent cosmology. This is only gaining insight into what could be the final end state. The real time dependent problem is to start with a non trivial field theory state, which is some instant configuration which straddles this maximum and which then falls. So that's indeed, that's a different, so that's a different box. For which we don't have a clear picture of what is the effect of potential. But we do have a clear picture of what is the vacuum effect. Where we can see the instant bomb configuration. This vacuum effective potential you get from computing the soluble solutions in the problem. And we do have a clear picture of what is the effective potential of the final state. And so it's a matter of interpolating.
Okay, so why don't we thank Carlos again? Just to remind everybody, if the talk group is at 2 o'clock, it's one floor down on the 3rd floor, and we'll keep it up.
you have is some field configuration, and then that all the glass, the one glass. Yeah.
Well, I was switching between these, like getting inside and standing.
Yeah.